Weatherly Report.
With Chris.
And Kyle.
A podcast about making music.
And life.
And life.
And life.
What's up, brother?
Not much, man.
Yeah?
Would you like to introduce our guests?
I would love to introduce our guests. So we have three of four or five? There's five, right?
Yeah,
five. Yeah, so we have three of five members from Schizo Calypso, which I love the name.
Well, I mean,
are we using that name at this point?
Yeah, we're not sure we're using that name at
Well, that's
point.
What's up on Facebook.
Yeah, it is. We've been just dealing with a trademark issue, which is actually a great lead-in because last November, I started getting these emails from CD Baby, and you know that like CD Baby like farms out your music out to like 45 different vendors.
Right.
And basically they're like, these three albums of your seven or eight albums that you have up here have got to come down because of the word, use of the word schizo and Schizo Calypso. Some rap artist in California had trademarked the word schizo. Now it's ridiculous because at this point there's literally hundreds or thousands of bands or people that call themselves schizo or schizo this or schizo that. So it's kind of like diluted in the first place.
Yeah.
Back in 96, we didn't like search band names. We just came up with things, you know?
Right. And I mean, back then we were calling everybody schizo. That was like a thing when I was a teenager.
Right.
Like, dude, stop acting schizo.
You're crazy.
Yeah.
We had the same thing, though, actually. I mean, with Weatherly, because we didn't know it. There was
this
a pop punk band
Australia.
Named O Weatherly. Like O-H, comma, Weatherly. We had no idea they existed until we tried to load our album up online.
And our album got put under their shit.
Well, which was Spotify did that. They lumped ours together. And I'm sure they were like, who the hell wrote this? Because it's not our band.
So where do you guys stand with that?
Well, I filed the paperwork for what's called a common law trademark in Maryland. So I have that. So, technically, we can always use the name in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
Where it gets hairy is there's no real jurisdiction for the internet. So, most of the internet companies are going to say, if you don't have a federal trademark, they're going to default to the person who has a federal trademark. So, those three albums came down, but he didn't dispute the other five or six that are up there, which I think is weird. So,
yeah.
They're still there. So, I kind of tiptoe around it because I'm not really sure, like, you know, how long this is going to take to get ironed out. We have the federal trademark is basically in suspended mode because there's another band out in California, a metal band called Schizo with a Z, and he started trying to trademark his name, and I'm thinking the guy who trademarked Schizo with an S just was going down and just like filing like violations against all the people that had these similar names.
Jesus.
So he's filed for his trademark. So
his music isn't getting anywhere. He wants money some other way.
Basically. Most likely.
Oh, that's awful. So y'all started back in 96 together?
Not together. These guys, I met these guys in about 2001.
Okay.
So I was just doing like solo records right out of high school and then around 2001.
Something like that.
Yeah. Met these guys and we've been playing together ever since. And then met Pat in what, 2014?
13, yeah.
And when we started doing We Love the Underground.
Yeah.
So when that kind of disbanded, then he hopped on board with Schizo.
Good. Awesome. Yeah, I like the We Love the Underground stuff.
Before we forget, actually, why don't you guys introduce yourselves and what you do in the band?
Are we on camera?
No.
Oh.
No, okay.
We're
going
to get to that.
We'll
stop fixing
your hair, Brad.
And that way people can associate a name with a voice as you guys go forward in it.
Yeah. I was wondering what you were looking at.
Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, I could, but we don't for this.
Let me start with Pat, because he's to the right.
Okay, I'm Pat Seiss. I play guitar in Schizo Calypso.
I'm Brian. I play guitar as well. I don't think they need my last name.
That's Brian Holmes. He plays guitar. And I am Brad Cox, and I sing.
Well, awesome. I can tell you it's pretty much Weatherly's likes are universal to you guys and to y'all's individual pages. I mean, I see y'all out all the time. Facebook is like the perfect stalking platform. Like,
yes.
I feel like I've known you for a year. This is the first time that we've ever met. Mm-hmm. So, where'd you guys record?
Yeah.
Well, Brian, why don't you
deep in Tony Crowley?
Well, yeah, man.
Yep.
I'm representing.
I was almost gonna say. I was almost gonna say 12th Planet. My brain got screwed.
Yeah.
So we recorded with Tony Corelli down at Deep End Studios down in Middle River, which is, we did one Schizo album there. You did all the We Love the Underground stuff, and
yep.
Then we done stuff too with John, who they kind of worked together. But We did the five songs there, started recording, was it, when did we start, February?
Yeah, about that. We were doing a song a month. That was basically the budget.
Kind of writing as we went. Like, some days we were going in, not really, we'd have, sometimes the song would be completely together, sometimes it'd be like, like I said, the night before, we were...
There were a few riffs that were written the night before.
Probably the two best songs, I, in my opinion, on the album are the ones that were, like, a total cluster right before we walked in the door. And even I didn't... I was working usually on Saturday morning, so I would come in and be like, what was the decision on that? You know, like, okay, is that lyric going to work anymore or not?
Yeah, we come into the studio, like, I remember a couple of them that came in, the same thing, I'd be coming a few hours after you and Gary late stuff, and I was like, I don't even know what this is. I like it.
Yeah. I like it. I have no idea where this came from. Yeah.
Me and him have had a good workflow with that. Just kind of sitting down with an idea and just develop it as we go and as we recorded.
Yeah, that was the thing is, Chris and I had never really wrote in the context of a rehearsal. It was always just writing in the studio, basically.
Well, yeah. I mean, definitely before...
And this being the studio, right?
Yeah, here.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, we have a Studio B at his apartment as well.
Yeah, my Studio B is my entire living room. So I have my TV hung on the wall, then I have my computer monitor right below it, then my speaker monitors, my rack mount, my amp, and then just a wall of guitars. My kid calls it his movie theater because my TV is coming through the monitoring speakers. So, I mean, we put Moana on and just turn that shit up. I'm surprised I haven't gotten complaints. But we do most of the...
So now I know that we can cuss on this show. I wasn't sure like if we were being PC or not.
No,
not at all.
We scrapped that after we tried on the first episode, and halfway through the episode, I was just like, "Man, fuck this! I can't do it." All
I think I need to address Brian Rumbly officially now.
Oh, absolutely. Go ahead. I told him. I told him we were going to talk about it.
Nice.
No, he's a great player, Brian Rumbly. Great player, great guy.
Yeah, so, I've been playing with him for about 4 weeks now. This was our third rehearsal together. I tell you, man, I hate learning other people's music. I was never like a cover person. I
feel that too.
I learned just the shit that I wanted to of the song so I could take the influence and move on from there. I never like learned the full songs. I'm like, dude, I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
But it's good money and you got to, and that's what bars pay for.
The weirdest thing about that is like you'll go to a party. And, you know, because you're a musician, people assume you can play just about anything, right?
Right.
But the reality is, somebody would play something. I'm like, I can play you 30 or 40 We Love the Underground or Schizo tunes, but I don't know how to play that Sum 41 tune or whatever.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
It's like here, I'll play all the solo parts in Hotel California. Here.
Right.
Enjoy that.
But it gets awkward sometimes.
As far as all the parts you can sing to, no, that's somebody else, man. Kyle.
Not being a singer, I'm the same way. People are like, why don't you learn the song all the way through? I'm like, well, because 4 minutes of it's like three chords that I'm not going to like. Like, I'm not interested in learning that part. Like, I want to learn like the cool riff. And then, but then you have all these chunks. It's like I go through, you know, like, when I was growing up, I was like learning Metallica. I knew like 900 Metallica riffs, but maybe only like three songs from like start to finish, and probably because we covered them at some point.
Yeah, same here, man. Metallica, Zeppelin. I mean, Zeppelin, I definitely learned a lot of the full songs because, I mean, it's Page. He kind of, everything he does is pretty much cool when you're first learning how to play guitar.
Oh, yeah.
I brought myself out on the cover thing early. I started, my stepdad's a drummer. So I started out playing in his country and classic rock cover band. They played corporate gigs and street dances and
fairs.
You
started out
and
carrying their shit.
Else. Yeah, I did. I started out carrying their shit. And then
How
I started.
Old were you?
15.
Okay.
And then I started running sound for them. And then they finally let me start playing with them. And then it got to be the point where if ever we showed up to a gig and it was a younger crowd than they expected, because I was, 15, 16, 17. I played with them until I was about 21, 22, something like that. But they were all 50, 45 to 55 was kind of the age range of those guys when I was playing with them. So every time we showed up somewhere and there was a younger crowd that they weren't expecting, like we ended up at a youth rodeo one time that they didn't know was a youth rodeo or some shit. I grew up in Georgia, by the way, that'll explain the context of a lot of this.
Makes sense now.
But, you know, so they would literally just turn around and look at me and shove me in the front of the stage. And it was like, all right, play every Sister Hazel and Hootie and the Blowfish song you can think of, you know, and appease right. that. And then when I ran out of that, I'd walk back to the backstage and sit on my amp and play Willie Nelson songs. So I burnt myself out on every, you know, Brown Eyed Girl, Sweet Home Alabama, all that crap. I did it for years, every weekend. But I made great money, and it got me through college. I mean, that was most of my working money through college. But I can't do it anymore. Cover gigs are very hard for me to swallow. As he knows, cover gigs are very hard for me to swallow anymore.
Yeah. Every once in a while when we need to finance something in the studio, then we'll set up and just replace the radio for 3 hours somewhere for $300 yeah. and pay our podcast fees and throw money on the Sweetwater card or something for the latest shit that we bought that yep. we probably didn't need.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, the board's over at Scott's house set up with all of my guitar shit.
Okay. But anyway.
Wednesday.
Well, very cool. So tell us about the latest recordings and what you guys are planning.
Well, it's me.
It's
huh?
on,
well,
you. It's on me, man.
Grizzly voice. The taste yeah. the cake's coming out.
They gave you oh, that, yeah, man. They gave you that you water. Know. You got to
get that husky baritone out. There you go.
Yeah, yeah. I had a tasty cake before I came in your house. So.
I understand.
What kind of tasty cake?
The eclair, you know?
Oh.
They're yeah. good, man, but I haven't had one in years.
You get the pumpkin pie ones that come out in another month or so.
Yeah, I guess so, but I've never had that one, but the eclairs are so good, it's just, I can't resist it, so.
I'm a fat kid at heart, man.
I'm a fat kid regularly, so, you know, yeah.
I like to maintain. I'll be sweating out Indian you know, food here shortly, figure. So.
Yeah, my sweat smells like garlic, typically.
You said you smell like tacos.
It's like pizza over here in tacos.
Pizza? Yeah, man. I mean, that's okay sweat, I think. But the new recordings, I mean, you know, it's an evolved sound, in my opinion, but I think it's just because there are different members.
Yeah.
And even with the writing we did in Underground, like some of the, you know, some of the stuff that Brad wrote and then I took and, you know, kind of brought my own voice into yeah. it. You know, it just really brought a different sound, I think. A little bit of a different sound, but it still has that Schizo Calypso feel. It's just evolved. That's cool. All. So, and, you know, I mean, we came into it, you know, Brad and I both kind of could tell that Underground was starting to fizzle out. And I started to think about, you know, there needs to be another outlet for me, because yeah. if I lose that, you know, it's going to be tough. And I'm in some other bands, but you know, it's like progressive and rock and metal is like one of my favorite genres all around. So I just needed an outlet for the creativity to come through. So, and Brad's a workhorse when it comes to writing music and having like just immediately, like if I send something to him, he'll have lyrics in the whole song written like in an hour.
This dude's doing six things at once all the time. I see his feed come up on my Facebook stuff all the time, and I'm like, Jesus, when does he sleep?
Yeah, and I get it.
He's hang upside down from my bedroom and fly around every once in a while.
But I, you know, I respect that because I work really hard too. I have a lot of jobs, and I'm a full time musician and teacher, and so it's. It's nice having someone else that has the same kind of drive that I have that to work hard and to do stuff. You know, when it comes to the creativity, you can't force it sometimes, but, you know, it's always there. And I always know that if I send something to him, it's going to be, like, he's going to be ready to go on it, like, the next practice. So it's an inspiration to write.
Yeah,
but we had, you know, we had these ideas and you know, a lot of it just came from like some riffs that Brian had already written and some like acoustic skeletons that Brad had with lyrics already. And they just sent them to me and I kind of just added some riffs and did some form stuff. And then we came in and tweaked it as we practiced together. But really it was just to continue, I think really to continue with the same creative outlet that Brad and I both had with Underground and just returning to something that was already a kind of a staple and established, you know, like Schizo is pretty well known around the area, so
it's
good to just have that background and be able to jump
it's
right
in. Probably one of the first bands I moved here 10 years ago. Yeah, I think Schizo was one of the first bands I heard of in the area, as far as original music,
really?
Anyway. And I'm trying to remember, I saw you play early on when I'd moved here before I was even in a band locally.
The punk hardcore version of the band.
it was, I'm fairly certain. I'm trying to remember where I saw you, but it's too long ago. I've lost that memory. I drank that memory away at some point. but yeah, so the first year and a half I was here, I wasn't even in a band, which was the longest I had gone not playing live music in my life, essentially.
Mm-hmm. It's longer than that.
What was that?
Time was longer than that.
Yeah.
It was harsh.
I spent that time learning bass. That was all I did.
That's true. You get your opportunity now.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the things we definitely wanted to do was not, we didn't want to rehash the past in any way. If we couldn't take it a step further, I don't think anybody wanted to do it at all.
Well, you kind of have to evolve as you go. You can't get stagnant. That's the death of creativity, because then you lose motivation.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
How much of your original fan base do you think kind of carried over?
That's a very interesting question, because I brought up the punk thing. The very first record was just because of skill and talent at the time, back in 96. It was kind of like the Nirvana Bleach. You know, it was just what it was. Mm-hmm. But because of that, there was like a really big punk following. And so the next album was kind of like alternative rock, and like all of a sudden it alienated a lot of the punk people. The third record was like goth and industrial, so it alienated the alternative people. So kind of used to doing that, and every time it evolves, it's like, well, we don't know who's coming out. And sometimes it evolves in a way that the original people kind of come back, like, oh, I like what you're doing now.
Yeah.
I hated the last three records, but...
I feel like your stuff now definitely caters to the alternative crowd a little more, and you probably, I mean, what drew me in was the progressive side of things. I mean, your guys' developments and transitions are, that's all I listen to music for. Is okay. To hear, I don't care about the riffs in the verse or the chorus. Sorry, I want to hear the development. No, but I want to hear how you get from point A to point B. That's my whole thing.
Yeah, that's a big thing for me in writing, period. You know, I studied classical music for my undergrad and undergrad degrees and stuff.
Where'd you go to school at?
Peabody Institute.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, okay. At JHU. So, and I
went to Shenandoah Music Conservatory.
Oh, great,
and
yeah.
And then did my master's at JMU with Dr. Hilliard for orchestral conducting.
Oh, nice, yeah. My teacher from Peabody, Julian Gray, he teaches at Shenandoah now as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
So, yeah, but my guitar duo partner just did his DMA there, actually. Nice. So. But, you know, so I'm used to studying those forms and, mm-hmm. and all that. And for me, you know, it's got to have that development. You know, that's what it's all about, you know. I mean, I can go write a song that's the same shit that's out there and it'll sound good, but that's not... It's got to be something that allows me to feel good about it at the end and express an emotion, you know, and something that someone else might be able to relate to, but really it's about... Getting that, I'm being happy with it. You know, the first band I ever started was a Tool tribute band, so I'm a huge Tool fan. And and Adam Jones has like a great quote. The guitarist, he said that, you know, it's really like good to be done, but it's done when it's good. You know, and I think that's the good thing.
I like that.
And that's kind of what I follow in writing. You know, so.
That's a good way to look at things.
It is. Yeah. It's also from somebody who has had to deal with Danny Carey just randomly adding and fucking taking away beats as he pleases.
Yeah, I'm all for it, man.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm gonna have to remember that analogy.
Absolutely.
I've always equated it to like you have to kind of like being, you know, a painter or something. You have to know when to put the brush down.
Yeah.
You have to know when it's done.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's a skill in and of itself, is knowing when it's done and to quit fucking with it.
Yeah, it was hard for us to put the album down once we finished and got to the part where we were getting ready to start mastering everything. There were still so many things that I wanted to change. But at a certain point, I'm like, no, let's just leave it. You know, I've put everything I have into this album.
Yeah.
I mean, our album is 14 years of writing for me stuff that it's always my go-to. When I pick up a guitar, it's always the same riffs that I play and the same developments that I play that I've never been able to do anything with, because like you said, I needed an influence, I needed an inspiration on that.
Mm-hmm.
And that, as soon as Kyle got a hold of my stuff, I mean, it just took off from there,
right,
with no problem, and vice versa. That was why we
kind of knew it was something that was going to click when he sat down one night in here to grab the
acoustic. We knew before then.
Yeah, but that was when we're like, all right, we're writing a fucking album.
So I don't know if y'all know the story, but I used to run sound at Brass Monkey way back in the day.
Mm-hmm. I used to book that club, right?
Yeah.
So you know about the upstairs.
Oh, yeah.
That weird-ass room.
I was there for about 7.5 years.
Yeah.
As a sound guy, they would randomly like send me people from Sheffield to train on the board. And then I don't remember who took over after me, but that was probably in what, in 08?
No, it had to be after that, because I got here in 08.
Oh, yeah, and I know I ran sound for you guys a couple times, but I didn't know him. But Screams and Whispers was one of my favorite bands to come in the Brass Monkey. I love those guys.
Yep. Yeah.
And I had no idea it was him until I responded to an ad when I needed to get back into music. I was like, I got to do something. I have 4 degrees in music.
Wasn't even my head.
And I'm not doing shit.
You responded to the same ad
I wasn't even
to.
Teaching. And so I responded to an ad, and I was like, yeah, you know, I'd love to audition to be your guitarist. Like, ambient prog rock backing tracks. I'm like, yeah, I could do that. You know, I'll just twiddle and play around and create some ambience, paint some pictures. And before I got together with the band, I was sent to get together with him and work out all the songs. Me and him sat down and worked on the songs for maybe
an hour and a half,
and yeah. then just jammed the rest of the night. And I was like, all right, we got it down pretty good. And then after he left the band, I left them a month later, and he moved up to Bel Air, and that was kind of the starting of Weatherly.
Yeah,
nice.
So I could tell when you guys were playing together at Vagabond that there was definitely a cohesion there that you guys...
Yeah.
Yeah, well, when I knew that it was really going to click... You know, I knew that we had a lot of fun writing together and that we kind of had the similar goals. But when he came in one night and sat down with an acoustic and was just like, all right, so I got this thing. Let's see if we can do something with this. And he started playing, and I was just literally sitting here like I am now thinking as he was playing it. And I got up and I walked over to that brown box sitting right over there on that table and snatched a set of lyrics out of it that I was looking for nice. And sat down. And in 10 minutes, the song was written. It had lyrics.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it was just something that I've been sitting on forever. And ultimately, that's what our album ended up being. It was music that he and I had both been sitting on for a long time.
Yeah.
There was only
two
tracks that were just totally fresh.
Shoegaze and Walk With Me.
Yeah, Shoegaze and Walk With Me were totally fresh songs that were just written for the album. Everything else was something that we had just been sitting on.
Yeah.
And we approached that album as, number one, we had to figure out how to work together. Because we were basically going into the studio having never really played a show outside of the context of that other band together. And we only did that
once at Fishhead.
We only did that once at Fishhead.
That was it.
And that was it. And that was, and I already knew I was leaving the band when we played that show. That was literally me kind of going, hey, this is your shit now. I'm out of here. it kind of worked out because it allowed us to kind of, number one, get all those things out that we've been sitting on forever that we kind of felt bad that we're just languishing.
Mm-hmm.
And it allowed us to figure out how we were going to work as a production studio because we're mixing and mastering for other people and doing some tracking with smaller groups, you know, singer-songwriters and whatnot.
A lot of production at the moment.
Yeah, mostly production at the moment. So we wanted to figure out, number one, because he had run a studio before. I'd been recording myself, and I'd recorded all the Screams and Whispers records. So I'd never really done a lot of work with other artists, kind of just my own shit for a long time. So it was us figuring out how we were going to go get our workflows together and create our sound of how we were going to do things. So the record was kind of a business card, honestly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To an extent.
Pretty much every song on the record is up for grabs, except...
Yeah, we'll sell any of it.
I like to say that A New Story, which is track 4 on the... track 2 on the album?
Yeah.
Jesus. Because that one... I wrote that guitar part... 16 years ago and never did anything with it. Had the developments done, the whole nine yards. It was already an established song. I can't write lyrics. I can't write harmonies. I can write choral works. I've got like 20 a cappella choir pieces and full symphonies with freaking chamber choirs.
Yeah.
But I can't write pop or standard vocals. I can't do it. I don't know why. I can't. It's astonishing.
That's because I like talking to other people that write lyrics because they can come from a lot of different perspectives. I found, honestly, once I met my wife and I had stable relationships and all of those kind of things, it became a little harder to write lyrics. There wasn't much turmoil going on, right? It's hard to write happy songs and them actually be worth a shit sometimes. So what I ended up getting really good at was being observational and looking at other people's lives, other people's issues and dramas and different things happening.
I gave him plenty of material.
Chris had some shit going on at the time. I got really good at kind of approaching it from that, you know, writing either from that person's perspective or from the outside looking in, kind of about situational things. And a lot of the record ended up being that. It was me writing about situational stuff when I needed to write fresh lyrics for certain things. A New Story was one of those. He named it. He came in and said, this is this, it's called this. And I was like, well, do you have lyrics for it? No.
No.
All right.
It's kind of become our anthem.
Yeah.
It's like our... Yep. It encompasses everything Weatherly, I'd like to think.
Yeah.
So where do you guys tend to draw your influence from, and then we'll get to inspiration. Because I like putting a crowbar separation in between the two.
I mean, this particular release, I mean, there's obviously writing about somebody else's perspective. That's mm-hmm. one way to kind of kill the writer's block. Or you could be self-reflective, and over a certain period of time, you're gonna have more and more and more material to be self-reflective about.
Yeah.
Or, mm-hmm. if all else fails, you could create an alter ego and write through that person's eyes. And if you want to start writing some kind of, like, risque or fantasy kind of stuff, that works out really well. Because then if the wife asks, what is this about? Or who is this about? It's like, it's not me. It's Nikki Thunders. He doesn't know what to say. He's a pervert. I don't know what to tell you about.
I do like that character. I do like that character.
He got me out of a writer's block at one point. So,
yeah.
Yes. But this particular... release is very self-reflective, because just doing it for so long, like we all, on some level, we're chasing a dream at some point or another, and like whether the good or the bad that kind of comes with that, where are you at now? And that was what I was writing a lot of this about. Like the first track, Reaching for an Emerald Sky, has a lot of like Wizard of Oz like mm-hmm. imagery in the lyrics, and you know, in that movie, she's looking for something, but at the end, she realizes that if it wasn't in her own backyard, then she didn't really lose it in the first place.
Yeah.
So, this is just very self-reflective of the ways dreams can build you up, but also leave you kind of deflated, too.
Yeah, good perspective. Mm-hmm. What about you guys?
Go ahead, Brian.
When we're writing, usually it starts with like a... Brad comes in with usually a pretty simple, you know, acoustic type skeleton. And like, you know, between Pat or myself, we kind of like to take that and, you know, take it apart and then kind of turn it, make it more riff based. Mm-hmm. And we kind of balance like whether, you know, who was doing what. We usually kind of would just sort of, someone would run with an idea, whether it was me or whether it was you.
Yeah.
Cause that's how he likes to write and get his vocals down. And I'm not a chordy player. I like pretty riffy stuff. So I kind of like having a shell and seeing what I can do with it, you know, not make it super complicated, but like just kind of make sure it's got its my own kind of flair to it.
Add the layers.
Yeah. So, and whether it's comment or complimenting something Pat does, or you know, decide to make a riff that kind of runs on its own. But really, my method is I just listen to the chords. I start playing stuff and just kind of stream of playing what comes out, and eventually it turns into something.
Yeah.
I'm not really one to sit down and like write out part for part. I just like to like loop a riff and see what I can do with it.
Yeah, that's how I am with guitar, definitely. Just see what certain elements will automatically just start locking themselves in.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get to a certain part, no matter what you've done around it, you're just locked in to hit that part, and then it just kind of keeps spreading out.
Exactly.
You have some consistency. And yeah. Pat?
Well, for me, influence-wise, I mean, I'm just really big into progressive music. I mean, Tool, like I said, Tool is a huge, mm-hmm. huge favorite of mine growing up and everything. But I listen to Mastodon all the time. I listen to Periphery all the time.
Yeah.
The Contortionists, Between the Buried and Me, some of these heavy bands. Finch's album, Say Hello to Sunshine, is awesome. I've been mm-hmm. listening to that a lot recently. And I get into fits of listening to artists, and I mean, when I do it, I just listen to them. And I listen to like their whole catalog over and over again.
I can relate to that.
I will exhaust myself on listening to
them. It's like binging on Netflix.
It really is, man. And it's great, because you start pulling like things that you like and things that move you. And so those are big influences for me. But obviously, you know, classical music is a huge influence for me, because I spent the better part of my life studying it, and mm-hmm. you know, really studying it hard. So. So that's a pretty big influence. I think right now it probably would be more of like forms that I kind of bring from classical stuff. Not really, you know, harmonic contour or content. Really forms, I would say, more than anything. Because you know, a lot of the songs, I think there was only one song that we kind of all wrote together, and even we had more input on Brad's melody, and that was the last song that we recorded. But most of the other ones had melody already. So.
Yeah.
It was really just us figuring out the riffs that kind of satisfied what was happening in Brad's vocal melody, and not stepping on his toes, and but still being able to have the layers that were nice and everything. And
it is refreshing to hear and also work with musicians that actually are respectful of what the others are doing with the song.
Yeah.
That's not always common.
No,
I'm sure you've probably all been through that with other
I think
people
this is
bands.
This is the best balance we've had, because there always ends up being some kind of push and pull, and sometimes, you know,
right.
And that's one thing that's helped was said with kind of the remote writing, doing similar to you guys did, like putting songs in Dropbox. Mm-hmm. I can't think of really any of a time where like you'd be like, here's an idea, be like, nah, dude, that sucks. Like everything was right. Yeah, everything like it was an improvement from the last time I heard. Like we, you know, you've all been in that situation where someone comes in with an idea and you're like, all right, who has to address?
It's real simple when there's two of you.
Yeah, who has to address that this?
It's either step up or eat it.
Yeah.
That's the thing that me and Kyle also decided on in the beginning of this. When we first started working together, we had a conversation that lasted, I think, maybe 2 minutes long. And the basic principle was get your head out of your ass.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to the other person and get rid of pride. Have a little bit of humility. So there has been times that I've sent Kyle a guitar part, and he's just called me back, and he's like, dude, that sounds awful. You need to re-record it. I'm not putting that on the album. And I'm like, okay. And I go back, and I re-record it, and I send it to him, and then we get to where it goes. There's other times where some of his lyrics or some of his vocals, I'm just, it doesn't happen often with him. But I'm like, I don't like that at all. That's got to go away.
Yeah. Or there's other ones for just opinion thing. Like there's on our album the first song, it's the scratch vocal is still
Found
on
Wanting.
The original is on the release because he wouldn't let me re-record something. Actually, I did re-record it, made him A-B it, and he still picked the fucking scratch track.
It's just it's raw. It sounds natural. Mm. It doesn't. There was no force behind it. It was just him getting the vocals out so we could build from there. And it just, I don't know, it just had a certain quality that I didn't want to get rid of.
I don't hate it re-listening to it. So
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I mean, to create music, you got to be humble. You have to be willing to sacrifice. You know, things that it's got to be whatever's best for the song.
Yeah.
Whatever's going to make the song sound the best and create the best experience that you can have musically. So
one of the things that I came to the understanding of
wearing glasses.
I know, but I'm just taking it in. Like,
yeah,
it's more inspector.
At some point, everybody that comes down here to podcast comments on those pictures.
Yeah,
happens. Those are my strange dog pictures. One of the things that I came to the realization probably later than I should have in life was that if you're willing to make music with somebody, you have to concede the fact that you're doing that because that person can make your music better.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And vice versa, that you hope that you can help them make their music better. If you don't have that cohesion and that understanding going in, there's no point in even getting together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, and I'd fought through many bands in the past, you know, mostly prior to moving to Maryland, but where it was, you know, well, you know, this guy's a bass player because I can't find another bass player. This guy's a drummer because God knows we went through three others and this is just going to have to do, even though I don't necessarily agree with him,
you know,
60% of the time or whatever. You know, so yeah. I had learned very early after moving here and getting out of the scene in Florida and Georgia where I was that I was like, you know, I'm not doing that anymore. If it's not people that I think are bringing something to the table that is elevating things, that I respect their opinions, if I find myself diminishing what they're saying or whatnot, then I shouldn't be in the same room with them anyway.
That's a good one.
You know?
I mean, for us, I know. I mean, Brian says he's like, he listens to the riffs I send him, you know, and it's like, oh, this is good. You know, it's not because I write a riff and then it's like, there you go, check it out. It's because I write a riff and I go, that sucks. And then I rewrite it and then I rearrange it and then I rewrite it. And then by the time I send it to the guys, it's something that I know they'll like at least. Mm-hmm. And then there might be some suggestions to tweak it. But that's after I've gone through the process of just beating the crap up out of myself. And I am absolutely my worst critic. You know, I mean, I still there's still things that I just think are awful.
Me in a vocal session is a nightmare. Me in a vocal session is a nightmare. I'm my own worst critic, and I will curse at myself. It's bad. But, I mean, ultimately, I get where I want to be with it. But
I had to switch over to using Reaper instead of Logic and Cubase mostly because of his vocal sessions. So I would be as fluent on Reaper as I was on the others for sitting right there while he's doing 50,000 takes and us using the first take anyway.
We don't often always use the first take.
Most of the time.
But yeah, that's one of those things. I'm definitely my hardest critic. But I'm in the same way when I'm working with anybody that's doing vocals in here. Now, I'm not critical to the point of like berating somebody by any means, but I don't let a mistake go on a record, especially vocally, because it's so present in front. You know,
right.
There's times where if you pinched a bass note in the background, you're not going to hear it. on the record. You know, it's fine. There's no need to go back and do that. Or we can fix that, or we can have. But with a vocal, it's so hard and it's so present. Yeah, you know, it's just like a lead. I'm not going to let a mistake in a lead lie. It's got to be fixed, you know? If I'm not happy with it, I know when I listen to it every other time, I'm going to hate that it's there or something.
Yeah.
I can fix the thing. You know, and that's what I've told vocalists that have been in here working with us. I'm like, if you hear that back later, you're not going to like it. And if you leave it on the record, you're going to be mad you did it. Yeah. So let's just redo it. You know?
Yeah.
So. But yeah, so what's your guys' plan for the release for this music?
We're shooting for... We actually did promos at some point that said, like, coming summer 2018. Well, that didn't happen. So I can't actually share that promo anymore. So the idea is, I think we're...
Still technically summer?
Yeah.
The end?
Yeah. Well, by the...
By the time you release, be fall at least, yeah.
So we're doing the show with Green Jelly, mainly because...
that's awesome.
There is a Tool connection. Both Maynard and Danny Longlegs was in that.
Danny Carey.
His name in the band was Danny.
Oh, yeah, okay.
But, so... And
Eddie Vedder had a little stint in there, too, didn't he? The original Green Jelly?
I don't remember.
Maynard, Three Little Pigs time?
I just know Maynard did the little falsetto parts in the Three Little Pigs, and
Danny
Carey was the drummer for that album, so...
That's
how all those Tool guys met, was through that band, really. I mean, a lot of it, so.
So we just thought that would be fun, a way to kind of kick it off and warm up, and then we're going to do the release show probably at the end of October.
Okay.
So coming this fall, winter.
Yeah,
fall. Yeah.
I mean, I think
Where are you planning on doing it?
We're planning to do the release, the digital release.
About that.
Though.
Oh, we're going to do a digital release in September.
Before the show.
So that way when people come, they'll actually know the songs.
They'll know the material, yeah.
Yeah, we did the same. We did our digital release before we actually had our release show.
Yeah, we did digital release in February and then used the Start Something showcase as our release. It was in like March, right?
Yeah, it was that storm. Remember all that rain?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that rain.
Yeah.
my sump pump didn't like that rain. I had I was standing in the walkout while it was raining, bailing out my walkout to keep it from coming in the house because my sump pump was not happy about things. So it's been fixed since then.
Thankfully.
Yeah. But, that was, and our release was a little bit different because with Weatherly, we kind of always said if we want to play a full scale show, we're going to bring in the musicians to do the album the way it was recorded because Weatherly is just he and I.
Yeah.
But for the release, we didn't necessarily want anybody else on stage for it just because it was the Weatherly release. So we chose to do it acoustic, and that was the best format with something like that. And we knew it's a seated show. People are actually going to sit and listen, and we can talk about what's going on and whatnot, a little more storyteller format kind of thing. So,
yeah, it was fun. We're actually we're getting ready to start working with the Deadpens, Dana Kosh's group.
Yep.
We're going to start doing some production and recording, mostly mixing, and maybe a little re-recording depending
initially,
on how their tracking comes out.
Yeah, they're doing all their own tracking, but we're going to do overdubs here, basically, is what that amounts to.
Nice. And then Bradley James, he's
doing
three
everything here,
tracks down. We got scratches, and we have our stuff built out for him, bass and drums. But we're going to be backing him.
Yeah.
So, more music for me to learn.
He's great.
He actually, it was just yesterday, the day before, that he contacted us and said he'd gotten a show. It's the week before our show.
Yeah. So it'll be good practice. It'll be good for us to get in front of
backing
people.
Backing him, so.
You get to play bass.
I get to play bass.
You get to play bass.
I never get to play bass.
Happy about that. An actual guitarist who, when you give him a bass, plays like a bass player.
Wow.
It's astonishing.
Well, it's because I spent a year and a half learning from a guy from Peabody, actually, that was tutoring me in bass.
It's astonishing.
Yeah, I play bass in Goodbye July, so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I can relate.
Awesome.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, I don't get enough. I'm getting a lot more chance to do it, and I got rusty for a long time.
It's fun.
And
it's
I've gotten back to it.
Well, I stole all the Life of the Funeral bass lines from you, except for one chorus.
But you were the right person to play that, though.
Yeah, they're very prog, acoustic duo. We just built out a 4-song EP for them. So I did pretty much all the bass lines. You replaced the chorus. That another situation where he was like, yeah, that chorus does not sound good. He was like, I'll take a stab at it tonight. And he threw something up the next day with my bass lines and his chorus on the bass over top of it. And I was like, dude, that's perfect.
My section of recording was maybe about 15 seconds. And then I just copy and pasted it in every spot that it needed to be.
Yeah. But back with the transitions and the developments, they have a lot of, they're wonderful songwriters. They have a lot of great ideas, but a lot of it was just block, 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 block. Mm-hmm. And there were no real transitions. And two of the songs, they were very present, and it was definitely deteriorating the song quality a little bit. So we pitched them, you know, let's add some strings in there. Yeah. Especially because they're like acoustic red. Like the red with a little bit of Hurt influence. You can definitely hear the Perfect Circle influence and bands like that. So I got to write some pretty cool string parts for them.
Cool.
Came out really good. And I pretty much just wrote to create the transitions. That was my sole focus around it.
Yeah, the only thing instrument-wise on that record is me. I mean, I programmed the drums for that record. Yeah, that's also something I got really fun. It's because of where we're at, the fact that I've got kids and everything, I don't track drums here, obviously. So we're doing everything programming drums, which has actually worked out really well working with smaller singer-songwriter
On our album, we have
like
a lot
that.
Of people asking us who our drummer is. Like a lot of musicians
like
who
tracks.
Do a lot of recording.
Toon Tracks is our
like,
drummer.
Who's your drummer? I'm like,
they can't
easy.
Hear the sound like a Mike Kidd or something like that.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
I've found... if you work with it enough and you don't, you know, a lot of people get the drum programs like that and they just want to go, okay, well, here's this block of MIDI and I'm just going to throw that in and that has to be my verse. I can't really fix it from there.
Yeah, we steal segments and
create
our own blocks.
You know, I'll take, you know, 10% of a verse and stick it in here because it's the right transition. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I probably spend 2 to 3 hours on a song just programming drums to get everything right.
Yeah.
You know, and then... you know, you have to kind of augment and play with sound to make it actually sound like it's in a room, you know. But because it can sound sterile and dry if you don't deal with it, essentially.
The biggest tip is just play with the velocities of whatever the strong hand and the weak hand is.
Yeah.
Because then you can create that humanization. Uh-huh. You know, when a drummer's doing a fill, his left hand, and he's a right-handed drummer, his left hand's not going to hit the drums as hard as the right hand is going to. I don't care how good of a drummer you are, it's not going to happen.
Right.
You have a dominant hand.
Yep.
So
it's just all a matter of how detailed you want to be with it, doing it that way. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that's one thing that we did run into, even with Life of Funeral, or some hesitance on, you know, using programmed drums. And
Gary's definitely got a dominant hand, but I don't think it's for drumming. We'll have to talk about that later.
Well, that's why I tell... No, I'm not
fair point.
Just play Megadeth.
Fair point.
And here we go.
But,
nice.
Yeah, well, awesome. So how long did it take you guys to track all five?
5 months.
5 months? Oh, 5 months of song. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, one of the coolest things that we were able to do was bring in some of the old players from the different eras of the band.
Oh,
so,
very cool.
I actually wrote a song on piano, but it was kind of a skeleton of a song, and I knew she'd play it better, so I sent it over to her in California, and she rewrote like the whole thing, sent it back, and then we played to that, and it's one of my favorite tracks. But it was cool to bring her in, Cherry Teresa, shout out. And then we brought in one of the old bass players, and we're just trying to bring some people into it that made it special to us.
That's awesome.
That's the right way to do things, man.
Yeah.
You know, that's...
makes it mean more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even if it's just to the people playing on the album, it's still...
Not only that, I'm just very big on, if you're writing a record and you hear something in it and you go, you know what, I know the right person to track this specific thing, go get that person and do it right.
Yeah.
You know, rather than try to fight, because otherwise you're just not going to be happy with it.
Right.
You know? That's a lot of what we do with this. I mean, we've farmed out certain stuff. We're working on some bass lines for something, and he's pulled in another bass player that was, you know, the right person to do those tracks.
Nice.
You know, so it's just, that's the way we like to operate. And that's, you know, the whole Weatherly philosophy of getting stuff done is like, oh, get the right people and get it done.
Yeah, my ego wanted to play the piano.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I knew that, yeah.
Oh, our record, there was a whole song that I had on guitar that doesn't have a guitar on it on the record. It's just a piano now. That's
well,
it.
He had this song, very beautiful. It's called Question. Track 11, 12. No, 8. Track
8. Yeah.
I don't even know. I just put fucking record on and listen to it on my way to work every morning. And I know from the time I leave Bel Air to the time I get from Crofton, I can listen to our record in its entirety. And I'm good. That's how I start my morning, every morning since February. A little narcissistic, but it's a damn good album.
So, well, I mean, we're all addicted to listening to our
tunes.
Any musician that tells you they don't listen to their own shit's lying.
Yeah. So he brought me this song, and he was like, here, you know, I've had this song for a really long time. We recorded it way back in the day, and I listened to that recording. I was like, yeah, that's nothing that I would have done to it. So he recorded just his acoustic part and his vocals, and I wrote a very classical Les Mis style guitar part to it.
Yeah.
And when we started getting ready to put it to the album after we played it a couple times, we started putting it towards the album, and I was like, hey man, what do you say we kind of adapt this to piano? He's like, oh, okay, sure, let's give it a whirl. I was like, all right. I got rid of his guitar part and just wrote my guitar part, modified it for piano, and it stuck. Yeah. And we absolutely nice. Love it. But the only problem is I can't play the fucking song. I play trumpet and piano.
You can cheat a lot
trumpet
with
and guitar. I can't play the song. I can play the right hand and I can play the left hand, which is how I recorded it. I recorded it MIDI playing the right hand, then I recorded it playing the left hand, then I went through
studio
and
tricks.
Added all the stuff that I had actually manually written out, yeah, all the grace notes and stuff like that, where I wanted to put them. And so now we're in the process when we start playing our album out live again. It's like, you know, I gotta get a pianist. Yeah. I gave it to Mike Newberry, and then he looked at me tonight and he was like, look man, I think you kind of overestimated my piano capabilities. And I was like, well, I gave it to you because I can't play it.
So we'll still be searching for that.
So we're still searching for that.
Yeah, we have a tune that kind of works. I mean, the tune that Cherry, you know, sent back is Brad sent it to me, and then I added more layers and moved stuff around, and we put strings in there, and there's a classical guitar in there. I mean, it's got a lot of layers to it.
It'd be tough to pull off live.
Yeah, it'd be really hard to pull properly. Off live. Yeah, yeah. It would be difficult.
We
would need
at
least a string quartet.
Yeah. It's going to be a strange moment in our set when we get to that song, if we do it and have the pianist, because we're both literally going to put down guitars and go stand next to a piano, and that's it.
I don't know how I'm going to do that.
It's going to be interesting.
Kyle's a very good vocal coach. Like, he knows from studio, live settings, any kind of settings, Kyle knows how to read a vocalist and get them to the point that they need to be. Working on the album with Kyle, I've never been a vocalist. I've sung in choirs and stuff like that. I have fairly decent pitch. But as far as being a vocalist, I am not. Not even freaking close. And so lately, he's kind of been pushing me more to sing as much as I possibly can, do more YouTube videos, stuff like that.
Pat hungry.
Which Sorry. Is great.
He's growling over here.
The tasty cakes.
It's been too long since my last tasty cake.
Yeah.
That's
I need
funny.
More.
So when we get to this song, it's going to be, I mean, there's a lot of backup vocals in this song that I did on the album.
Right.
It took me many, many takes to get it right on the album.
Wasn't that bad.
In my head, it was.
I've had much
in
longer
my head,
sessions
like
for harmonies. I've had much longer sessions for harmonies than what we had. That's the good. The thing is you came in with good pitch. That's honestly, that's if somebody doesn't have good pitch and they're coming in trying to sing, that's the hardest thing to fix.
Yeah.
I mean, you can auto tune stuff so much, but
you'll notice it.
You'll notice it.
You're not damn close. It's going to be noticeable.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You know, auto tune is good for correcting minor things.
Breath support.
Yeah. Yep.
That's my biggest thing.
So, but yeah, no, I like working with vocalists. That's fun. I've been singing since I was 5, so that was, you know, I've always sang. I don't remember not singing, essentially. So, but yeah, all right, well, cool. So, as far as, and this is something I always, the business side of music, what do you guys use for digital release?
Typically CD Baby. Okay. Because you're going to farm it out to everyone else anyway.
Right. Okay, well, cool. And as far as digital platforms
it'll
for
be,
download and streaming, it'll be everywhere.
iTunes, Amazon, all that.
Okay, cool.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, there's like 45 of them, like literally.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know where they go.
The Xbox music.
But all of a sudden you'll search for a song
title.
Like, it's everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the same thing. We used a company called Songcast for ours.
That's right, there's TuneCore now, too.
TuneCore's another good one, and that's the other one we considered for this. Mm-hmm. We didn't go the CD Baby route, number one, because we had no desire to deal with physical copies at all of anything, even if people wanted to order them. I was just like, no. Just go straight digital. I haven't bought a CD myself.
Well, the
in
cool thing is that Amazon gives you that option. So if somebody goes on Amazon and wants to actually buy a physical copy of your album, Amazon will print it on demand.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, they have a new service through there. Once they have your music for digital purchase, you just upload your artwork, and if somebody actually wants a physical copy, they'll burn it and send it.
I listen to a lot of records. I'm still trying to get a record of our album, but I got to find 45 seconds to cut out of the album in order to fit it on a record.
We have to remember that for the next record, so it'll fit.
I know.
Well, cool. So, so the 5 songs that you guys that you handed me when you came in, so that's going to be the release as an EP?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
We may be tracking one more thing as a kind of a surprise.
Okay.
There's an old tune that, like, everybody loved it, and it was always, in my mind, incomplete. Like, I recorded it, I recorded the acoustic and the vocals, and this girl came in, and she, Sarah Parks, and she played the violin, and then I presented it to Brian and Gary. I'm like, what do you guys think? And they're like, we think it's done. It's like, it's not done. It needs drums and bass and all kinds of stuff. It's supposed to be epic, and it never happened. So we may go back and finally make that happen, but people liked it the way it was. And
yeah.
And it's not bad to really release multiple versions of things. We've talked about that with our record, is doing way different versions of some of the songs.
Yeah.
Here and there. But,
yeah, definitely.
But, all right, well, cool.
Still trying to get him to lean a little more towards the metal side. Yeah. When we started working together, he handed me a Sister Hazel DVD and a Collective Soul DVD, and he was like, here's your homework. And now I'm like, all right, motherfucker, here's Devil's Wears Prada, here's Asking Alexander's earlier shit, and here's some All That Remains and some As I Lay Dying. Get to work.
Nice. So, much like you guys, our next record's going to be nothing like the first record.
It's cool. And it kind of fed into the gimmick of the whole thing, like schizophrenia. Yeah.
Well, that was kind of my thought, you know, when you said that, and I was like, oh, that actually really makes sense. That works with
After I took the emotional hit of losing fans, that, like, when you're 18 years old, you're like, oh no, you know, it's kind of scary at first. And I was like, I'm going to play into this now.
You have to take the Kyle Kinane approach, if you're familiar with that comedian. There's a line in one of his comedy specials where he's going into like some pretty weird territory with a joke, and he just stops and looks at the audience. He's like, listen, I'm willing to lose most of you to gain a couple of you. I was like, that's a really good fucking way to think about it. It's like, you guys will be back. You'll just be pissed off for a little while.
Right.
You know, it'll be fine. So that's the way I've looked at it always. But, you know, it is going to be an interesting stretch for me to go that direction, because Screams and Whispers was a heavier band than what we've done with this record in parts. Little more alternative, I guess you could say, than anything else. But I've never really been... I mean, back in Florida, I was in a very much a Sister Hazel-esque band. Three guitar front, me on acoustic all the time, big harmonies. It was that thing. But that was what we did back then there.
Yeah.
It was very regional for that. But coming up here and getting more into the alternative, that was the weirdest thing. And I don't know... You guys have been around the area longer than I have. When I first moved here, I was like looking into original music, and I was like, all I see is punk and metal bands. That's it. That's all I see.
Yeah.
And I was like, and that's cool. Like, I'll go see punk and metal bands. I enjoy that stuff, but where's the other stuff? And it really didn't seem like until for the last 4 years is when I started to see a lot of other stuff really crop up to some local popularity anyway.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's 4 or 5 years, I guess. But yeah, for that first couple of years I was here, I didn't see anything.
When I was Joined the Cult in 1996, there wasn't a lot of bands with CDs at that point.
Mm-hmm.
There was like Laughing Colors or a couple guys. Like, I'd go up to Musicland and there'd be like somebody's solo record or like guitar work or something like that. So I was kind of like intent to like just let it all out. So I felt like it was like one of the first ones to actually put one of those parental advisory stickers on a local album.
Yeah.
As ridiculous as that was.
Yeah.
You know, but there was tons of punk bands.
So,
bands.
Some 13-year-old kid looked at that and said, "That's the record I want.
Right.
That's the sticker.
Right.
I'll take that
sticker.
That's the sticker. I'll
take
that."
Opposite of what it was supposed to do in the 90s.
No, those were the records we wanted.
Yeah.
You know,
if it didn't have it, you didn't want it.
Right.
Those were my go-to.
Yeah.
Tower.
Pretty much like Bon Jovi. No, over there.
My Dying Bride.
Green Jelly would have approved.
Yeah, Green Jelly would have had it. Actually, I don't think they did. Their music was not really explicit. It was just ridiculous.
I don't remember if it did or not. I had that record for sure.
Green Jelly Socks?
I can't remember.
The yellow one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't remember if it did or not.
It didn't stick with you.
Yeah. I can't remember. But so before we let you guys go, because we are kind of coming up towards an hour, I do want to ask you a couple things about the songs, and if you guys want us to play something at the end of the podcast, we'll put something through and tag it onto the end of the podcast. Yeah. If there's something you want to do, just a clip of something, whatever you guys tell us you want us to do, we'll tag on the end, so the listeners can actually hear what you guys sound like and make it out to your release show.
Cool.
But besides that, one of the things I've wanted to start talking to musicians that we bring in for the podcast about is sort of the Baltimore area music scene. I've seen it go through a lot of different waves of big ups and then kind of these big low points.
Mm-hmm.
What do you guys think of where it's at now as far as the health of the scene?
I mean, I guess Brad's pointing to me because I go to a lot of shows.
Yeah, well.
But for me, I mean, I graduated in 2012, and that's when I started playing rock again. I only played classical music and classical guitar. So when I came back, I started the band and then joined Underground. I think it's kind of been about the same, if not growing, since I've been in it. I mean, it's a family, that's for sure. I mean, everybody supports everybody, and there's a lot of people at local shows. Even like the Mayhem, people go out to that, mm-hmm. which is like the Kevin Hawk show, which is Thursday night. People are out, you know, until midnight and supporting everybody. So I think it's great. I'm having a great time down there, and I go out to people. They come out to my shows, and it's nice. You know, it'd be nice for it to continue growing. And I just did another podcast today for one of the other bands I'm in, and we were talking about how Annapolis is looking at what Baltimore is doing local wise, mm-hmm. and they're trying to do the same thing. And I think if that would be great if we can start. Baltimore bands can start getting to Annapolis more often and vice versa, and you know, we can Absolutely. Start sharing shows. And you know, last I heard, the DC like, you know, local stuff is just non-existent almost, so
it would be
nice if, you know, maybe we could figure out a way to start pushing our music to other areas. And I've mentioned that to a few promoters, you know, about like trying to get to regional areas. So, and it's good that Kevin Hawk was like doing stuff up in Philly for a bit and taking bands up there, so hopefully that can continue. And we all need to help to support it. You know, we have to keep going to shows, keep supporting people, keep supporting bands, and spread the news to people who might not know about the local scene and local music, and you know that we'll enjoy it. You know, if I meet someone that is gonna like, you know, a band like Semantics, which is really good pop music, then mm-hmm. I'm gonna share it with them and say, you've got to go see these people if you really enjoy this style of music, because they're awesome. So
that's who I was trying to remember to tell you about.
I've listened to their stuff a ton.
They're really great.
And there are so many great bands, you know.
There's a ton of great bands, and like you said, the scene does very much support itself.
Yeah,
you know, I mean,
I feel like Kevin Hawk's a huge linchpin in that.
Well, he is.
I mean, between Kevin Hawk and the stuff that Athena does,
is
just it's what Baltimore has been missing. What they've been developing in the Baltimore area, but it's what Baltimore was missing back in my Brass Monkey days. There was no cohesion.
Yeah,
no.
Now it seems like every band supports every band. We make it out as much as we possibly can. Especially we go to all the story times at Chesapeake Arts Center.
Make it all the Dan stuff.
Yeah, we get out all of Dan Hout stuff.
But I don't know. For me, it was an oddity when I came here because. I grew up in Georgia, but for the better part of my music career when I was down there, I lived in Tallahassee, Florida, college town, right? So, number one, bands were very much cutthroat because everybody wanted to get into the same venues because there was, you know, basically 12 venues probably that original bands played in down there. Mm-hmm. But the crazy thing is it definitely drove some competition as far as quality because the venues weren't looking at you to get people in the door. Drunk college kids were in the door anyway.
Oh, that's great.
They were in every venue. It was packed every night, you know, especially on the weekends. Your job was to keep them there. You ran them out, you weren't getting booked again.
Yeah.
So it was a very much a different environment, and the bands didn't necessarily support itself, but you could very easily cultivate a really good following of people that were going to follow you around. Whatever bar you were playing at, that's the bar they were going to be at that night kind of thing. And we definitely had that there. When I came here and I realized that 70% of the audience at a given show was other bands, I'd just never seen it before.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, number one, this is really cool.
Bands back then weren't sticking around for the full night.
They played.
That's one of my biggest pet peeves. If you left after a set, I don't want to play with you anymore. Because I'm staying to hear the whole thing, unless I got to go pick up my kid or something like that. Unforeseeable.
Yeah.
But I'm staying for the entirety. I mean, there's been times where me and him, just to show our support, I've gone in the beginning, and then when I had to leave, he came and relieved me. So at least Weatherly was still there to support whoever we were there. And that was Mike Newberry.
Yeah, it was Mike Newberry's show.
Yeah.
Yeah, we make a point to do things like that as much as we can. You know, I mean, not only because we enjoy it. I like going out and seeing musicians, but also, you know, you want to be there to support people, period. It was just a very different dynamic when I moved here, and I was like, this is so strange. Why is it all only other bands? I couldn't. It freaked me out at first because I was like, that's a whole different kind of pressure. Before, I was just making sure I kept the track people here. Now I've got a bunch of musicians that are judging me, and I know they are. You know, so
I think that's one of the problems with the scene. Yeah, you do get a lot of musicians out, and you lose. You lose the energy that you're going to get from a crowd that doesn't give a shit. You know, a crowd that's there to have fun and have a good time and hear some music. And I think, you know, I think some people can be better about that, who go to shows. And I'm not thinking of anybody in particular, but I'm just thinking overall, you know, when you go to a show and you're playing on stage and you're in like a huge, there's a huge crowd in front of you, and the majority of them are just standing there with their arms crossed looking
at
you.
Well, it's six other guitarists sitting in front of you going,
exactly. Yeah. That's good. Yeah. And, you know, it's like, okay.
Not really excited, just kind of judging each lick.
Yeah,
one
exactly.
The next.
It's like, hey, man, you know, I appreciate it. But, you know, if you're on stage and you're rocking out and you're having a good time and I can see that you're energetic and expressing yourself, I mean, I'm going to get into it.
Yeah, we're
going to
feed off of
feed
it.
Feed off
of it,
definitely.
After shows, I typically go home with a pretty sore neck, man. Like, my hangovers are pretty bad. So, but it's because I just get lost in it. I remember one time when I saw Paradry. I mean, I went nuts, man. I was like, drank a little bit too much, but
I love that.
The next day, my neck hurt so bad because I was just headbanging, like, just the whole time in the front of the stage. Yeah. And I didn't care about anyone else. You know, I wasn't trying to hurt people, but I didn't care if somebody saw me having a good time.
That's the way it should be.
Enjoying it, yeah.
I mean, I want people to cut loose at a show, but that is something I noticed about Baltimore shows. It was just that it was a lot of musicians, and they're there appreciating things. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not. It's not like they're sitting there going, "You fucking suck," and you see them like smirking and walking away and shit like that. You don't generally see that every once in a while, but you don't generally see that. No. They're there to appreciate things, but it's a different energy to play in front of. It's a very different energy to play in front of.
We used to go into like Salisbury and Ocean City because it was more like you were talking about in Georgia, where it was like just keep the people in the room.
Yeah.
So we would play like, what were some of the venues up there? It was like Pulse Nightclub, Secrets.
That Monkey Barrel was right across from the college, and it was just like. They'd just be like, they didn't care. You could play anything as long as it was like
loud.
They'd be jumping around and singing along and just hammered on those whatever the hell drinks they had there.
But to what you were just saying before about like playing in front of a lot of bands and band people, like we played a show like in Western Maryland in front of, we have no idea what to expect, but it was like 40 random people just standing around what was an old like funeral home. And they loved it.
They loved it.
It was like they'd never heard live music before.
That's awesome.
And we made more fans at that show than I think we did the entire year prior to that.
I mean, they were like asking
because
for autographs.
Because we could play for the same people every time.
Pictures and autographs.
Yeah.
Like what?
That's how it was with the church shows with me growing up. I grew up in PG County. And down there, you either went into D.C. and played Black Cat, or you went into Springfield and played Jax, or you played at a church. And the church shows were usually on like Wednesday nights, and it'd be 500 fucking kids at a church show.
Yeah,
they just didn't care.
Yeah. Yeah.
They just wanted to hear music.
Yeah,
and those, I mean, some of the best shows that I've ever played. I was like 16, 17 years old, just playing nonsense.
Gary, I mean, we've got to shout out the Beller Bashes with Gary Musioli, and those were some of the best shows. Same thing. A whole like auditorium filled with kids that just want to like rage.
I think it's just the problem too. The problem is people are everything. It's just overexposure.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, they don't want to let loose. Someone might be filming. You know, it's just, and they've heard it. You know, you've heard it 1,000 times. So it's like they know what's coming, and they're just judging if they hear a mistake or. You know, so it's like, you know, fuck all that, man. Just get into the moment. Like, experience something.
Appreciate
what's
happening.
You didn't have to, like, sit there and worry about, like, somebody, like, Facebook Live-ing the entire thing. So all of a sudden, now the pressure is not just the musicians in the room. It's like, how many people are watching this right now? Did I just miss a word or whatever? Yeah. Gary miss a beat?
Well, that's one thing. I've always been big into adapting, knowing when to adjust what you're doing for the venue or the scenario or whatever that you're doing. If we're out playing and there's a bunch of people that we've never played in front of before, then I am playing the album note for note. I'm playing everything that I wrote as precise as I possibly could, like Second Saturday Cafe when we played with Normandy Wood. That was probably the most precise that I'd ever played.
Minus tempo, we probably could have just put on the record and played to it.
Probably.
I mean, there was a few things we played a little slower or faster, but... Nice.
But if we're playing at a bar and we're playing in front of 50 people that have already heard us 50 million times, I'm ad-libbing the shit out of everything I possibly can to avoid having that, to avoid having somebody, because I'm a very self-conscious musician. I try not to be, but I really am. Like, I get so stuck in my head that if I'm kind of putting my own influence on things and adapting as I go, then people have less of a chance of judging me as far as trying to recreate something that they've already heard a bunch of times. And that's one of the beautiful things that I really enjoy about playing with Kyle, is no matter what I do, he's following. He's good. And vice versa. Like, we've knocked out...
We both
out,
have a good ear for each other.
We've knocked out beats and songs by accident, just getting our strum patterns off, and you can't even tell. Like, we've made it work, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's certain types of music that you can do that. It would be tough for us to go off, like, you know, unless we had a section of a song that's like, let's extend this solo for Ryan so he can go off more. But typically most of our stuff is very... It has to be reproduced, or else it's just going to be a shit show and fall apart. Yeah.
Well, we have certain ones that are like that. Like, I've seen that strum pattern. If I fuck it up, we're done. You know what I mean? It's just, it's oddball. I don't know.
I hate playing that song. I love the song, but I hate playing it because most of the time we play, we it's just me and him on acoustics. All of the songs have acoustic versions of the album, of the produced version, and that's the way that we wrote them.
Yeah.
We wrote them on acoustics, and then we adapted them for an album to be fully produced, and then we maintained all the differences. So we have the acoustic versions, and then we have the produced versions. Mm-hmm. I've seen is just one that doesn't translate, because all I'm doing is just playing a lead lick over top of everything. Yeah. And I'm like, dude, this is so boring to play on an acoustic. I'm like, let's speed it up, man. Play like 12 BPMs faster. He's like, I can't do that, because it's already a pretty fast song.
It's a pretty fast song with a lot of lyrics. With a lot of lyrics. The faster it goes, the more dense they get, and then it turns into garbled.
Yeah. Pretty much.
Yeah.
Speed that song up like 12 BPMs and see.
Yep. Well, excellent, excellent. So, whatever song you want us to play some of at the end of the record, why don't you tell us a little about, or the end of the podcast, why don't you tell us a little bit about whichever one? Or we could play a piece of all three. It's up to you.
Are you playing all three of them, or?
I will do whatever you guys want me to do. I know it's pre-release, so I only want to put out there what you guys want us to do.
I mean, because I already talked about Reaching for an Emerald Sky. That's the kind of the single one. That's the nuts and bolts tune for us. And then I guess Eulogy of Me would be a cool one.
Okay.
That's the track 4 on the disc. And that's the one where Cherry Teresa played the piano.
Oh, sweet.
He's very padded, did some strings, and everybody's on it in some capacity, I think, except for Gary.
Gary's not on there.
Yeah.
But, that's right. Anyway, it's a very self-reflective song, as it would sound like it would be.
Awesome.
It's really kind of a deep tune, and the very end of the song is an acoustic version of a tune that I wrote in Los Angeles when I ran away as a kid, and I still had the recording. It sounded terrible. So I just replayed that at the very end of the song. Yeah. Kind of like beginning the end kind of thing.
I love that.
That's very cool.
Yeah. I try and keep stuff like that in my mind as much as possible. Just it helps create, you know, alliteration and soundscaping.
Yeah.
And a story.
Yeah,
a story.
So I had to dig through all these like tapes and like find the tape, and I'm like, oh God, it sounds pretty rough.
Yeah.
For our younger audience.
So now let's put a speaker, let's put something in front of a tiny speaker and actually record that back.
That's what we did. We just set up two mics in a room and laid it out.
Yep. No, there's nothing wrong with doing that. Well, very cool. Listen, we appreciate you guys coming in to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
We definitely want to make sure we'll be there at your album release, whenever that is.
Yes.
Once you get it scheduled, absolutely, for sure. So keep us in the loop on that.
Babysitters.
Babysitters. I've got two. He's got one.
Here, having to hire them for shows with all the kids.
That is the hardest thing about getting older as a musician, when all the people you normally invite to a show start having kids.
Yeah.
And they're like, no.
You just have to have like a fun zone or something, you can drop them all.
That's what we need. Is we need a concert venue right next to like Chuck E. Cheese or something. You guys dump in there.
After hours Chuck E. Cheese.
You guys all go beat the crap out of each other in a ball pit.
This is the opening act. It's the Chuck E. Cheese band.
Yeah.
That is great.
Well, excellent. Well, again, thank you guys for coming in. Keep us in the loop. Yeah. Everybody, please check these guys out. There will be links to all of their social media stuff in the podcast description when that comes out. So,
yeah. Also, check out Pickle Cables, Kurt Main and Strings, and all things Weatherly on YouTube, Weatherly Report Podcast, which you're listening to, and Weatherly
practicing this.
And Weatherly Band. Fuck you, man. You messed it up. That was going to be the one that we were actually going to cut the promo on.
dream.